Okay, so tonight's topic is medieval Jewry's confrontation with Christianity. And as we did last week, we're going to start with background, historical background, with thinking about who, where, the concept of Ashkenaz, the Jews of Ashkenaz. That's going to be our focus for the evening, and the experiences of Ashkenaz Jewry during the medieval period. The word Ashkenaz, generally translated as the area of West Germany and Northern France, Germany in general, is Ashkenaz. The word Ashkenaz actually is in the Torah. Ashkenaz was one of the descendants of Adam, of the first people to walk this earth. So there is a reference early on in history to such a nation or people. Whether it's the same or not, that's an interesting question. And similar to the origins of the Sephardic community or the Sephardic peoples, Sephardic section of the Jewish people, there is a lot of mystery surrounding how the Ashkenaz community came about. And there are a number of different theories, legends, research, and no one really has 100% certainty on it. So we'll just share one or two of the thoughts, and then we'll jump into our discussion for the evening. So one of the theories is that Jews made their way to Western Europe over a thousand year period from the time, actually, during the time of the Second Temple. So when we say the Second Temple, we're talking around 100 years before the Common Era. So just somewhere in the middle, which is basically around the time of the Greek story of Hanukkah, the Greek rule. And we have evidence that there were already Jews living in places like Rome, in other cities, perhaps in Italy. And there were Jews living there, oddly enough, at the time when the temple was destroyed by the Romans themselves. And I always, when I was in Rome a number of years ago, I always have this strange kind of vision or image in my head when my wife and I were looking at the Arch of Titus, and we were noticing the pictures of the Roman soldiers celebrating their victory and the destruction of the temple, with the picture of the menorah, perhaps the shulchan, some of the vessels from the temple, whether they were actually parading those through the Roman Forum in the Roman streets. I wasn't there. Hard to know whether it was just a depiction or not. Where are they keeping these things? If they brought them back to Rome, do they still exist? Those are a lot of interesting questions that people have been thinking about for a long time. But what was interesting to me is when I understood that there were Jews already living in Rome, I imagined to myself Roman Jews who were standing in the streets, whether they went to see it or not, while the Roman soldiers came back from Jerusalem with the spoils of Jerusalem. That to me was a very kind of jarring image to think up in my head. But what happened is Jews lived there for hundreds of years, actually thousands of years. We met someone who was there, who had lineage, 2,000 years of lineage in Rome itself. And that was from the 20th century, 21st century, all the way back. And he could trace his family all the way back to that time. So this is before the destruction of the temple. There were already Jews living in Europe, for sure in other places as well. But we know the Roman Jewish community was active, and they even created their own nusach, their own tradition of prayer, their own tunes. And then at some point, people started moving. Some understand that the movement took place when the emperor declared the national religion to be Christianity around the 4th century. And that started to become not so comfortable for the Jewish community, so people started to move. The earliest evidence that we have of strong, growing, larger Jewish communities in Western Europe is around the 8th or 9th century. And some fathers or famous people that you might have heard their names before, Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom, one of the fathers of Ashkenazic Jewry. He was born in 960, and he was born in a town called Metz. Metz was a sizable Jewish community, and one of the reasons why Jews ended up...
Lorraine
was another place. One of the reasons why the Jews ended up in these areas is because the Christian rulers were inviting the Jews to come and live for economic opportunity and for the knowledge that the Jews were good in business or good for the economy. They were invited to live, and they mostly settling along the Rhine, for those who know their geography. So Rabbeinu Gershom, one of his most famous enactments was the ban on polygamy, among other bans that he enacted. And that was 10th century. And this is really when the Ashkenaz community is starting to develop, is starting to grow, is starting to found yeshivot. Rashi is another big name you'll probably be familiar with. He's basically one or two generations later. He's in the 10th, 11th century. And then you have the descendants of Rashi, the Baalei HaTosfot, who are also all commentaries on the Talmud, on the page of the Talmud. We'll speak a little bit more about the Baalei HaTosfot later in the discussion tonight. So this is some background about Ashkenaz. There's obviously a lot more to say, but I want to jump in to the medieval age, which is not a happy time in Jewish history at all. But it's important to learn this history and to think about this history. So what you have on the page, you don't have to try to squint your eyes to see it. Everyone here will probably be familiar with what you see from the Yom Kippur service. What you see here is one of the central, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, one of the central components of our prayer service on the Yamim Noraim, and it's the Netana Tokef. And for those who ever looked at the bottom of the art scroll version of this prayer, you will have found the story which accompanies this prayer. And this is the legend that is told about how this prayer came about. We're in the 12th century. Okay, the first mention, by the way, of this story was in the 12th century. Sorry, it was in the 13th century by one of the early commentaries, the Or Zeruah. And he quotes an earlier commentary named Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn. Bonn was one of the Jewish communities. I believe Bonn is in Germany as well, or maybe northern France. I don't know where on the border it fell at that time. Not the same borders that we have today. And this story that's in the second half of the page is mentioned. The story about Rabbi Amnon of Mainz. But before I mention the story, I want to give one point of background, because we're talking here about the importance of studying history as well. There's a Gemara in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, Tractate Rosh Hashanah, which is the tractate that discusses the laws of Rosh Hashanah, when Rosh Hashanah falls in the calendar, as well as all the laws of Shofar and other related topics. So the Gemara, the Talmud, states that there are four things or four practices that tear up an evil decree against a person. Four things a person should do, or four things a person should engage in order for a person, if there's something that is kind of hanging over a person's head in their life, they should engage in these activities, a form of repentance. And the four are tzedakah, tefillah, tshuva. Those are three that are right there on the page. And then there's a fourth one that's quoted, shinui shem, which means to change your name. And some say not change your name, but change your location of where you live. And if you do that, if you do these four things, that will enact for the person a teshuva. So the commentaries on the Gemara ask, if you look in the prayer itself, all it says is teshuva, tefillah, tzedakah, repentance, prayer, and charity. Those tear up the evil decree. So if this prayer was based in any way on the Talmud, on the Talmudic line, it's missing one of the main components of repentance. So how can this be? So this is a little bit of a historical question. Let's first read the story, and then I'll share with you one of the approaches to this question. So the story, if you can read it inside, it's okay. I'm gonna go through it here. Written by Rabbi Amnon of Mainz, is the person who wrote this prayer, and he wrote this prayer. Did I not pronounce it correctly?
You're correct in English, but in German it's Mainz.
Mainz. Okay. About 1,000 years ago, it has become one of the highlights of the Chazan's repetition of the Musaf Amidah, both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I'm on the left side in that second paragraph there. This is the story behind it, as related, as I mentioned, in the Or Zeruah. The Bishop of Mainz insisted that his friend and advisor of Amnon convert to Christianity. In order to buy time, Rav Amnon asked for 3 days of grace to meditate upon the question. Upon returning home, he was distraught at having given the impression that he even considered betraying his God. So Rav Amnon spent 3 days in solitude, fasting and praying to be forgiven for his sins, and did not return to the bishop. Finally, the bishop had him brought and demanded an answer. Rav Amnon replied that his tongue should be cut out for the sin of saying he would even consider the matter. Furious, the bishop said that the sin was not in what he said, but in his legs for not coming as he had promised. And he ordered Rav Amnon's feet to be chopped off, joint by joint. They did the same to his hands. After each amputation, Rav Amnon was asked if he would convert, and each time he refused. So on and so forth, his body was brought to complete deterioration and cripple. And when Rosh Hashanah arrived a few days later, Rav Amnon asked to be carried to the ark. Before the congregation recited Kiddusha, he asked to be allowed to say Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name, in the synagogue as he had in the bishop's palace. And then he recited this prayer, Natana Tokef, and he died on that moment. 3 days later, Rav Amnon appeared in a dream to Rav Klonimus ben Meshulam, a great Talmudic and Kabbalistic scholar of Mainz. We have knowledge of this Rav Klonimus, and taught him the text of Natana Tokef and asked him to send it to all parts of Jewry to be inserted into the Rosh Hashanah liturgy. By the way, it's not usually found, interestingly enough, in the Sephardic tradition. In a lot of their machzorim, does not appear. So Rav Amnon's wish was carried out, and the prayer became an integral part of the Rosh Hashanah service. Sometime later, it was included in the Yom Kippur service in most communities. Now, this story is the story we've all heard, and probably heard from our rabbis on different years of Yamim Noraim. But what's interesting about this story is it doesn't really line up with the Gemara. As I mentioned, there are four items mentioned in the Gemara that will tear up a person's decree. So one of the answers that's given, and this was done in very, very in-depth research, that this prayer was actually found in another place long before the 12th century. This, I owe credit to this fact from Rabbi Jacob Schachter, who's a historian in Yeshiva University, J.J. Schachter, and I took a course with him on teaching Jewish history, so I heard this from him, so it's a credit to him, this idea. The 5th century in the Cairo Geniza, for those who've heard of the Cairo Geniza, very interesting history about that place. This is when this prayer was dated from, so long before the 12th century. And it was found in a stack of prayers written by, perhaps, they think, a paitan. A paitan is a person who writes different types of prayers, poems, piyutim. And his name was Yanai, and he came from Palestine, okay, that time. So he was basically a Yerushalmi. He was basically from Israel. And if you look in the Palestinian Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi, and you look at the same passage about the items that cancel out a person's evil decree against them, it only lists tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah. Those three. So this will answer the question of the Marasha, why only those three are mentioned in the prayer. Perhaps this prayer is more reflective of what was written in the Talmud Yerushalmi as opposed to what was written in the Babylonian Talmud, but it also calls into question this whole story about Rav Amnon. So this is a great question of history, of trying to understand how history informs our religious life, and of course this story is a very horrible and horrific and painful and jarring story, which moves us, and the Tana Tokev is such a central motif, central part of the Yom Kippur Rosh Hashanah service. At the same time, all of a sudden, I'm not here to debunk any kind of story, but it's interesting to learn history and see how it opens you up to view it from different angles. So for me, it's a window into the world of these Jewish communities, more than it is necessarily a commentary on which is the true history and which is the right story. So let's jump into this question about forced conversion. We spoke about it last week in the sense of forced conversion to Islam, but we have to consider how that would change or be different when it comes to forced conversion to Christianity. And as we know, and we're going to go back and forth on this throughout the discussion this evening, Jews were forced to convert to Christianity in similar kind of amount of times that it happened. It didn't just happen at one particular time in history for Jews living in Muslim countries. It happened over time, many times, at different points in medieval history, especially in particular, for Jews as well. Let's consider for a minute that question and what that meant for a Jew living in Spire, Worms, Mainz, any of these major centers, which those are three that were actually destroyed in the Third Crusade. We're going to talk about that also a little bit later. So we have two explicit statements. They're not the only ones in the Rambam, in source 2 and 3. The Rambam, Maimonides, who we spoke a lot about last week, he writes explicitly, although it's only explicit in the uncensored versions of the Rambam. The Christians made the printers censor the writings, which had the words Christians in them, and you'll see in a moment what I mean. So the first one is a discussion about wine that was used by a non-Jew who was worshiping an idol. You're not allowed to even have benefit from a wine that was used by a non-Jew in the service of idolatry. And not just this, you're not allowed to drink wine from somebody who's just not Jewish. That has nothing to do with the idolatry issue. That has more to do with getting too close, rubbing shoulders with people that aren't believing and living the same lifestyle that we are, so we don't get into issues of kashrut, intermarriage, things of that nature. That's how it's understood from that angle. So when the Rambam says, with regard to any Gentile who does not serve false deities, and he says the Arabs in the uncensored text, it says Christians. It's Christians, by contrast, are idolaters. It is forbidden to benefit from their wine. So that's not written in this version. That's written, as I said, in the uncensored version. And the Rambam is of the opinion that Christianity is idolatry. That is the Rambam's approach. He says that as well in source number 3. When it says the Canaanites are idol worshippers, he's not referring to the Canaanites, he's referring to the Christians. And Sunday is their festival. Accordingly, in Eretz Yisrael, it is forbidden to conduct transactions with them on Thursday and Friday, each and every week. And needless to say, on Sunday itself, when transactions with them are forbidden everywhere. We don't want to give them support on their holidays. So the Rambam says this explicitly in a few places. And actually, the Rambam writes in his commentary on the Mishnah that if there's a city that's filled with these people, you should try to not pass through there. Right? You should try not to pass through there. The Rambam was against going into churches. As you could imagine, he was very against all of this. The challenge becomes, that is the Sephardic approach. And the Rambam did not live in the Christian countries. He lived in Muslim countries. So what did the Ashkenazic thinkers and halachic decision makers have as a different approach to Christianity? So the answer is, it's complicated, but it's different than the Rambam. And I'm not going to get into too much technicality here, but we'll just give one or two moments of introduction. There is a Gemara in the Talmud Bavli that talks about not going into business with an idolater. A person should not go into business with somebody who practices real avodah zarah, real idolatrous practice. The reason you're not supposed to go into business with them is because if you get into a fight with them, they will end up cursing you in the name of their God. And non-Jews also have to abide by, as we know, according to our tradition, the 7 Noachai, the Shiva mitzvot b'nei Noach. And one of those 7 mitzvot is idolatry. Even non-Jews are not allowed to worship idolatry. It's one of the seven Noahide laws. Did anybody tell them that they're not supposed to be doing this? How are they supposed to find out? That's a whole topic in and of itself. Nonetheless, if you, a Jew, are causing somebody else to sin, that's also a sin. That's called lifnei iver lo titen michshol, putting a stumbling block before the blind. It's one of the negative commandments in the Torah. So you shouldn't go into business with somebody who believes in idolatry because you might cause them to say something about their idolatrous, and you're the one who caused them to do that. Someone's pointing fingers over here. So he's creating a scene. So in the commentaries, okay, in the commentaries, there is a long and wide and it's ongoing discussion about how the idolaters of yesteryear, of once upon a time in history, and at that point, when the commentaries were discussing, they were talking about Christians. The Tosafot, the Balia Tosafot, were living during this time of the 12th, 13th century in Western Europe, and they're talking about the Christians of their time. So if this Talmud, if this passage in the Talmud is telling me I can't go into business with these people, is that a reference even to Christians? What is our position on Christianity? And there are different variations of what I'm about to say, and we're just going to keep it as simple as possible. And the assumption of many of the commentaries is that the Christians, even of 1,000 years ago, or 900 years ago, did not believe in their system in the same way that the original Christians believed in it 600 years before that. If you have any recollection of early Christian history, it didn't start out as a monotheistic religion. It was a breakoff of paganistic Roman beliefs. And if you look here in source number 4, this is what I was referencing. This is the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, who's providing the guidance for the Ashkenaz community. And the Ramah, again, is writing basically 16th, 17th century, around the time that the Shulchan Aruch was written. And he writes, some are lenient with partnering with Kutim. Here it's a reference to non-Jews in general, these days, because the Kutim of these times do not swear by idol worship. And even though they mention the foreign idol, nevertheless, their intention is to the creator of heaven and earth, except that they join the name of heaven and foreign gods. So here he's referencing what we are, this understanding is of what Christianity calls the Trinity. Without getting into this too deeply, because I'm not an expert myself, Christianity is a monotheistic faith in that they believe in one God, that there is one God. But according to the commentaries, they're attributing other kinds of forces or powers that are related to that. And that's called shituf. That's called shituf. That's called having other forces or powers that are partnering with God. So it's not classic idolatry, it's not Avodah Zarah, the same way the Rambam would categorize it, but it is something that we don't want people to be believing in. So if we're saying that someone's forcing a Jew to convert into such a belief system, we would still say that it would be problematic. Maybe not as problematic as the Rambam's version, but problematic nonetheless. If you go further ahead in history, even a few hundred years, there are commentaries that are already saying that the Christians of that time weren't even committed like the Christians of 200 years before of the time of the Crusades. So fast forward to the 21st century, where you have so many different streams and strands of the Christian faith, and to try to figure out what each one believes and what each one has in terms of their approach would be pretty complicated. But one thing that we understand is that in the 12th century, this was a hot issue. This was a real live wire, and it was something that was not recommended. And if Jews were being asked to convert, it was a very difficult choice to say yes, as opposed to in the Sephardic lands where Islam wasn't viewed as a form of idolatry or something that's close to idolatry, whichever. When you have the Rambam on your side writing you letters and telling you, it's okay. It's okay. It's not meaningful. It's not meaningful. It's not so simple. So let's look at two stories, two kind of episodes that took place, and they both came to two different conclusions. There was a question that came to Rashi himself. And it was a question about a couple who had been married Jewish. Jewish people that got married. This is source number 5. And what happened in the story is the husband converted to Christianity. He was forced conversion, and he converted. And the wife, whether she wasn't forced, or she didn't choose, or she was able to get out of it somehow. And the question that he was dealing with was, is there a necessity now for the husband to give his wife a divorce document, a get? So he writes here in source number 5, Ha'alama shenikacha l'shnayim, shneim hayu anusim, they were both forced. Lavor al Torah Moshe yedei goyim, v'gam ha'edim ki yotzebeim hayu, ro'ani shehi tzricha get. In other words, and Rashi says he needs to give her a get, and what does he mean that he needs to give her a get? He's still considered Jewish. And this is really what they were debating. Jews who converted out, were they still considered to be Jews? Can you leave the fold? Is there such a thing as you can cancel out your Jewishness? So according to this, and you can imagine the impact of such a statement. A Jew who converts out of the faith is still a Jew. That's a very strong statement. Sha'af Yisrael mishumad l'tzono shekidesh, says even a Jew who was forced against his will, who gave the wife, who gave the woman a ring and said, I would like to marry you, kiddushin, they're considered married. It's considered a marriage. Why? It's based on an earlier saying, Shenamar, Chata Yisrael, if a Jew sins, Afal pi shechata, even though the Jew sinned, Yisrael hu. That person is still a Jew. The kol shekein, ha'anusim shebelibam l'shamayim. Rashi here is assuming that people who were enforced into conversion weren't happy about this, and they weren't actively going out and becoming members of the Christian church. They were trying to keep whatever they could in private and in public. Maybe they wore the cross, or they dressed, or they went with the group, but they weren't happy about it. So to say that to somebody like this that, sorry, you have to go through the conversion process now if you want to become part of the Jewish community again, Rashi was of the approach that wouldn't be the case. You may be familiar with the brother Daniel case. Daniel Rufazin was born Jewish, two Jewish parents, but during the Holocaust, his parents hit him with a couple who were Catholic. The couple raised him Catholic, and he actually became a Catholic priest. Brother Daniel's called the brother Daniel case in modern Israel, where they talk about immigration. They all talk about the brother Daniel case. He came to Israel, and he applied to become a citizen of Israel under the law of return. Very similar concept to what Rashi here is talking about. Person who converts out and wants to rejoin the faith. The Israeli Supreme Court denied his application, saying that since he converted, he was no longer a Jew. That's actually what the Supreme Court said then. And he had to wait the customary time for any other non-Jew to become a naturalized citizen. Just as in the U.S., you have to wait 6 years to become a naturalized U.S. citizen. So halachically, according to Rashi, the Supreme Court was wrong, and they should have let him become a citizen. But Rashi wasn't the only one who weighed in on this. Source number 6, there's a story about inheritance. It was a question that was asked to the Rashba. The Rashba was a Sephardic commentary, but he was using a precedent from an Ashkenaz, or an early Ashkenaz commentary, the Rabbeinu Hai, probably even before there was really an Ashkenaz, and he was asked about a Jew who left the faith, if he's allowed to be part of the inheritance, the Torah concept of inheritance, meaning does he get cut off from the family because he left the faith? What do we say about this? So the Rashba writes, look in source number 6, Imiresh avi dvar Torah kachiruni min ha-shamayim, de-mishumad eino yoresh aviv Yisrael, a person who converts out gets cut off from the inheritance. So this is taking the other extreme, that a Jew converts out of the faith, loses their Jewishness, loses their Jewish identity. The Kevan de Meshumar Unafak Lemi Kedusha Yisrael, loses his sanctity of being a Jew. Umiktushad de Avu of Ashechan de Lohavia Yerusha El Labar Yisrael. Inheritance only applies to a person who's a Jew. De Miyaches Batar Avua goes after the father. As it says in the Torah when it speaks about inheritance, Tichtiv, third line, Venatati Lacha Lazaracha Charecha. Actually, sorry, that's by Avram. I'm going to give to you and your children after you. So it only applies Mishazar Miyuchas Acharav when the child or descendants can be traced back to that individual. Yatsa Mishumad, who's excluded? Someone who converted out. What does it say by Avram Avinu? When Hashem said to him, Yadoa Teida, he promised Avram what's going to happen to his people in the future. Your descendants are going to be a stranger in a strange land, a land that's not their own. And who is that a reference to? That was a reference to Yitzchak. Because Yitzchak is called your Zera. What about Yishmael and Esav? Those were also descendants of Avraham. What is he suggesting here? Not my words, but he's suggesting that Yishmael and Esav were kicked out of the inheritance, in a way, in a sense. I know that doesn't sit comfortably with everyone.
But there was no Jewish law then.
There was no Jewish law, but there were laws of... You're saying this whole idea of inheritance is an anachronism. Well, using Abraham as a proof is an anachronism.
One of the issues is that it would send you to the public, to the Gentile courts,
yeah,
to deal with, and would hold the Jewish right. law in contempt.
Right. So I will point out that this comment of the Rashba is not practice, is not actually the conclusion in Jewish law. He's writing in the 14th century, 13th century, the Shulchan Aruch, which is the code of Jewish law. When the Shulchan Aruch speaks about this case, the Shulchan Aruch writes, there's no Torah violation, meaning the person is not kicked out of the Yerusha. If anything, it could be done as a punishment, but it doesn't mean that the person is left the fold. So he probably maybe was siding with the earlier opinion. But I bring this to your attention because this was obviously a very, very challenging issue. And it's so important to see it in context and to hear what kinds of questions were being addressed to the leadership of the time. So we're going to come back to the topic of forced conversion in a few moments. But let's jump to another really exciting topic of blood libels. Yeah.
Is it reverse true that if a Christian converts to Judaism, do they lose their Christianity?
If a
Christian converts to Judaism, do they lose their Christianity?
As far as I know, the only two religions you can't convert out of are Islam and Judaism. As far as I know. I could be wrong, but I do not believe that a Christian who leaves the Christian faith is considered as if they're still Christian. I believe it's considered as if you've left. But I can't speak for every stream of Christianity. I'm not an expert in that question at all. But that's my understanding. So yes, the blood libel is a very difficult topic. But we're coming up on the holiday of Pesach, and in a way, what's striking about this history is you would think that something that's a lie, that something that's been proven false time after time, people would stop talking about it. But no, no one stops talking about it. And we have blood libels in every turn of the corner, from every place on earth, even to this day. But the way that it impacted our Jewish life will actually raise your eyebrows a bit. And this is all about, this whole discussion here is about how the Jewish community responds to challenges of the time. And the fact that we had to change our practices because of certain accusations laid against us and our community is just fantastic and beyond really the ability to understand. So what I want to point out, first of all, is one short note, the first official blood libel recorded was in the 12th century in 1144. That one was called the blood libel of William of Norwich. I'm not going to speak about that one tonight. But that officially started these themes. One of the theories about how the blood libel came about is during the Crusades, Jews were showing Christians that they were willing to give their lives and the lives of their children for their religion, to kill themselves, to kill their children, to not have to be forced into conversion. So the Christians made what we call a kal vachomer. They said, if the Jews are willing to give up their lives for sanctification of God, then it probably wouldn't be so far-fetched that they would be willing to take our children for religious purposes as well. This is one theory that's been advanced about how the blood libel came about. So a lot of people have asked this question. Where did it come from? And that suggestion is based on the fact that 1144, I'm going to mention in a moment, three, that was basically just after, I have it here 1 second, just after the, yeah, just around the time of the, between the second and the third crusade. So some people did not like this suggestion at all. They thought it was crazy. They thought it was really, for a number of different reasons. And one of the other points that's been made, which seems to be a little bit more logical, is that the Christians were just getting frustrated that they weren't able to baptize as many Jews as they had set out to in their campaign on the Crusades. And more Jews were giving their lives instead of actually converting. So out of frustration, out of retaliation perhaps, this came about. So there are three stories here, each one unique, each one different, and each one kind of painful in its own right. The first, which is on the left, it's actually out of order, but the one that's on the left is called the case of Anderl von Rinn. Rinn is a town in Austria, or a city in Austria, and a story about a boy named Andreas Ochsner, or Anderl, and he was supposedly bought by Jewish merchants, and then cruelly murdered by the Jews in a forest. And the blood was collected in vessels. Now, and that's the caption. This was a card or a poster that was created from 1462. What's amazing about this is people after the story wanted this boy to be in the Christian faith to be canonized as when a person becomes a saint. And they wanted this martyr story to become a saint. Problem was that they had no proof that the Jews ever did this. So it never passed. It never passed for this Saint Andreas. That's what they wanted it to be. And the Pope himself shot it down. And he said, we don't know what happened. Nonetheless, this is a story in the 1950s, not too long ago. Souvenir postcards were being printed portraying the murder of 500 years ago of this story. So it was a complete lie. It was a complete fake. But it was being used to justify crimes and murder against Jews. The one on the right side, more recent in history, and maybe even familiar to some people here from the history books of the last century, Menachem Mendel Bayless. Menachem Mendel Bayless, the Bayless trial of 1913. Menachem Mendel Bayless was a Russian Jew. He was born in a Hasidic family. He was accused of ritual murder in Kiev. Now, what's interesting about the story is he was not a religious person himself. He worked on Shabbat and holidays. And he worked in a brick factory in Zaitsev. He was the superintendent. And he was there in 1911. This story took place in 1911. And this young boy, Andrei Uchinsky, was on his way to school and he disappeared. 13-year-old boy. And they found his body 8 days later. In a cave near Zaitsev, near this factory where this Bayless. So somebody basically told on Bayless to the authorities. And he went on trial. He was thrown in jail. He went on trial. One of his strongest alibis for the lawyers in the room is that he worked on the Sabbath, which is just interesting. Yuchinsky was abducted on a Saturday morning, and Bayless was then at work, and it was actually confirmed in a receipt slip for a shipment of bricks that he himself had signed that morning that was produced as evidence. He was eventually let off, and what was fascinating about this case later in history is the way that the countries of the world reacted when he was proven innocent. He became a pretty famous person, actually. I think they made a play about him. They might have even made a movie. Someone wrote a book about him. I forget what the name of the book was. And then you have this story at the bottom, which was really just after the time of the Crusades, a story of Hugh. This was in England. It was a 9-year-old boy. He disappeared July 31st. This story was turned into a fantasy tale, a horrific fantasy tale. But it was included in the Canterbury Tales, which is like famous literature. And this episode, part of this episode was the quote that you see there in the bottom part of the paragraph is actually a reference to this story. And they never proved it either. They actually wanted to make him a saint as well, but the Vatican never went for it. And they say one of the reasons why they never turned these are horrible stories. These are young children who died, were killed. They actually found the murderers, by the way, in the Bayless trial. There were four professional murderers. Like they found them, they caught them, and those people were brought to justice. So these are just three stories. There's a list on the internet of over 100 blood libels from the last 500 to 800 years of history. And we're still suffering from this. Achad Ha'am, I put it here in the, I think it's source 13. We could just skip there first and then we'll go back. Achad Ha'am, was a poet. That was his pen name. His real name was Asher Ginsberg. He's from the Ukraine. And he writes, every Jew who has been brought up among Jews knows as an indisputable fact that throughout the length and breadth of Jewry, there is not one single individual who drinks human blood for religious purposes. But, you ask, is it possible that everybody can be wrong and the Jews right? Yes, it's possible. The blood accusation proves it possible. Here you see the Jews are right and perfectly innocent. So he's writing this as consolation. You know, the existence of the blood libel justifies that everybody can be wrong. If you tell a lie enough times, people are going to believe it. And it impacted us. Look how it impacted us. Just a few examples. Source number 8, 9, and 10. We're coming up on the holiday of Pesach, and most people are probably going to have some form of red wine or grape juice on their table. But in fact, there was a time in history where it was dangerous to have red wine on your table, and it's mentioned here in Source 8. The Taz, one of the commentators of Shulchan Aruch, writes, Veha'idna, when he was writing, probably 16th century, he said, Nimnu milikach yain adam. We try to stay away from using red wine, mipnei alilot shkarim, because of the blood libel. Because if they see us drinking red wine, what are they going to think? That our halachic practice should be impacted by this, should be something that angers us and also opens our eyes to how history impacts our practice, how history impacts our traditions. Source number 9. This is a theory, but it's an interesting one. I never heard it before until I saw it in print from the Sansino Haggadah, that the reason why we open, one of the reasons suggested why we open the door for Eliyahu HaNavi at the end of the Seder experience is so that people can look in and check in on us to make sure we're not doing anything problematic with the blood libels that are going around the town. He doesn't really buy it. He thinks that it would probably actually make it worse for us if we have the door open and allow them to look in. Then they're going to have a reason to look for something. But the fact that these ideas could be circulated, and even in source number 10, this just fascinated me. The Egyptian community, this is quoted from Rav Avadya Yosef, who just passed away a few years ago, one of the great Sephardic leaders of the 20th century in Israel and around the world, really. And he talks about, he found in the book of the customs of Mitzrayim, of the Egyptian Jewish community, that they would have non-Jews be very involved in the matzah manufacturing process. Now this is something we try to stay away from. We try to have Jews be part of the process from beginning to end as much as possible, handmade over machines. We're going to talk about machines, I think, in 2 weeks. Industrial Revolution, we'll get there. Just before Pesach, we'll talk a little bit about whether you can have machine-made matzah and how it's related to history. It's a very interesting discussion. And he writes that they were permitted to have non-Jews be involved in the early stages of the kneading of the dough and other components of the so that there wouldn't be any suspicion that the Jews were mixing blood or something into the matzah. And that wasn't something that was ideal. It was less ideal to have a non-Jew be involved in the process, but to avoid the suspicion, the halakha or the practice was loosened. And that should strike us, anger us and strike us. In Source 11, a very powerful point, this is mentioned in a sefer called Yalkut Divrei Asaf, written by Rabbi Feuerstein, who's still alive. He's a Talmud Chacham in Israel. He's written many, many, many books. And he writes that at the time of the Bayless trial, I just mentioned it on the previous page, at the time of the Bayless trial, the way I read this, I think my understanding of it, he's referring to self-hating Jews, people who were very secular, who were very anti-religious. They were saying that because the Talmud says that, you know, Atem Kruyin Adam is a line in the Talmud, you, the Jews, are called humans. But the non-Jews are not called Adam. Adam, the word Adam, which means a human being. So that was a justification for a Jew going and committing an act of murder. Because if the non-Jews are not humans, then it allows us to do whatever we want with them. So this was a claim. They were using the Talmud as a, you know, an anti-religious document. And he writes in the left column, he says that they got it all wrong. He says that the idea of Adam, the reason why the Jews are called Adam, it's not that we're more human than them. It's nothing to do with that. Everybody's a human. Everybody was made in the image of God. His point is that Adam is that the entire Jewish people are one body or one entity. And when something happens to one limb, the rest of the body feels the pain. So that was the point. That when there's a trial of one Jew somewhere off in Russia, that the American community is impacted, that the European community is impacted, that everybody in the world, this case reverberated, if you read some of the literature around it, everybody in the world heard about this. And the Jewish community was rallying. He says, when a non-Jew gets put on trial, how many of his non-Jewish co-people around the world are fighting for him? In most cases. And that was his point. So let's shift to our last topic here. There's one more comment here on the bottom. We'll leave it off. Let's come back to the Crusades. One of the hardest times for Ashkenazic Jewry, probably in all of Jewish history, was started in the year 1095, 1096. The history is interesting, but we don't have time to go into all of it right now. But there was basically a call to arms by the Pope, Pope Urban II. Pope Urban II was trying to support the Byzantines in their war against the Turks. And he was asked to help. The Byzantines reached out to the Pope and they said, can you help us in our war? So the Pope basically made this call. And the language that he used was to go against the infidels. Now, infidels include Jews and Muslims. They don't include non-monotheistic faiths. That was who was included in that. So if you're hearing this call and you're someone living in one of these countries in Germany, that's where really this first major massacre took place in the communities of, we said, Mainz, Worms, and Speyer. It was a holy war. They were on their way to Jerusalem. That was the ultimate goal. The goal was to liberate Jerusalem. And in that first crusade, they were successful. It took them some time, it took them a few years to get there, but they ended up being successful, and they were liberating Jerusalem from the Muslims, because the Muslims had done a lot of damage to Christian sites in Jerusalem.
Those are referenced in the Tisha B'Av.
That's right. Many of the keynote come from this time in history, were written by some of the people who went through these experiences themselves. So the first crusade was in 1096. The second crusade was a little bit later, in 1147 to 1150, and that took place after a certain area was captured that had been created as a Christian area after the first crusade, and that wasn't as successful, and they didn't end up making it to Jerusalem in the second crusade. It also led to killing of Jews. The first one was horrible. These communities were wiped out. And then in the third crusade, there was another very tragic story, and that's it's hard to see it in the print, but this is a stone in a town called York, which is in England. And it's described here in Source 15, a little bit of the background of what happened there. The Jews of York, and the story actually took place, I just confirmed it, it was Erev Shabbat HaGadol. Erev Shabbat HaGadol, just on the eve of Shabbat HaGadol, which is basically next Shabbos. Next Shabbos going back 900 something years. And the Jews were told, convert or die. And this is just around the time of the Third Crusade. It's actually during the Third Crusade. And there was a rabbi of the town, his name was Yom Tov. Yom Tov ben Yitzchak. Yom Tov ben Isaac. Yom Tov, the son of Isaac. And he was called after his life. He perished. He was killed in this story. HaKodesh. I'm going to talk more about him in a moment. The Jews of York sought refuge in the fortress from the fury of the populace because they were told, convert or die. So they went, they hid away in this fortress. And after offering a vain resistance for several days, the most of them, on the advice of Yom Tov ben Yitzchak, joined him in voluntary death. And you might just call it a mass suicide. That's basically what took place here. Yom Tov, this Rabbeinu Yom Tov, was one of the Baalei HaTosfot. He was a student of Rabbeinu Tam. And these are real people. And we study their teachings in the Talmud. So in his memory, I just wanted to quote one Pesach-related comment. I think I have it here. There's a practice that we're all familiar with. We're going to do it at the Pesach Seder in just over 2 weeks. We break the middle matzah. The reason why we break the middle matzah is because on Seder night we're supposed to have a sense of brokenness, like a poor person. At the same time that we're supposed to feel free, we're also supposed to have a sense of poverty, of what it means to be a slave, of what it means to not know where your next meal is going to come from. And we hide it away. And when we hide it away, we're left with, officially, 1.5 matzahs. We add a third one. I'll explain why we add a third one in a moment. But we have 1.5 matzahs, because one of them is broken in half. So when we get up to the part of the Seder of Motzi Matzah, after the Magid section, we wash, we sit down, and we have Motzi Matzah. And what happens? We make the bracha of Hamotzi, and we make the bracha of Al Achilat Matzah, on the mitzvah of eating matzah on the Seder, Pesach Seder night. There's a debate in the commentaries about which matzahs you're supposed to hold in your hands when you make these brachas. Because we know that on Shabbat, we have to have two breads, two challahs, as a commemoration for the two portions of manna that fell on Friday, because the man did not fall on Shabbat. So that double portion that fell before Shabbat is commemorated every Shabbat by having two challahs at each meal. But Yom Tov, there's a debate whether the man fell the same way, double before Yom Tov, or it even fell on Yom Tov. And the understanding of some of the commentaries, Rabbeinu Yom Tov among them, so we'll quote it in his name, was that the man actually indeed fell on Yom Tov. And therefore, there's no reason to commemorate Shnei Halechem, the two breads, on Yom Tov. See, he says something fascinating. This is not the custom. I've never seen anybody follow this custom. It does not seem to be the custom in our communities. But his custom, and it's quoted in the Tosafot in Talmud Psachim, his custom was that at the Seder, for Hamotzi and for the Al Achilat Matzah, he would just make the bracha over the broken piece of matzah. He wouldn't have any whole matzahs over there. And in his name, it's you know, to learn something about a person we're studying, the history of this town, of this tragedy, it's very emotional. It's something to keep in mind as we come to this time of year. Our practice, by the way, is we have three matzahs, and we make hamotzi on the one, the two, and the broken one in the middle. Hamotzi lechem min haaretz. Then we drop the bottom one, and we make the al achilat matzah on the broken one, because you're supposed to do the matzah on the broken one. That's the general practice that many people have. But this is a story of people who gave up their life. This is a story. It's okay. People who gave up their life for a religious need, a time of religious persecution, and that's mentioned here in source 16. It's a pasuk in Bereishi. Suicide is something that is a form of murder in Jewish law. But there are certain situations that we know of in Jewish history where people took their own lives because of extraordinary, extreme circumstances. So the pasuk in Bereishit, this is really from the story of the flood, post-flood. But your blood of your souls I will demand an account. And the commentary writes, this is a warning against suicide. The word but, ach etimchem, the word but comes to teach that at a time of religious persecution, one is allowed to take their own life. And there are going to be extreme circumstances, like in source 17, where these girls and these boys were on a boat at the time of the Roman persecution of the Jews, the end of the Second Temple. And they were asked to get involved in illicit relationships. The girls jumped into the water and gave up their lives. The boys did the same. And we understand that it's not a simple concept. We spoke at the beginning about Christianity and where it stands and what our position is and how we understand that faith. And obviously these are excruciating concepts and excruciating decisions that we should never have to go through in our time or ever again in history. But the idea is that look what Jews were willing to give up. And look what Jews did give up, and we can't necessarily judge them either under the circumstances. That's something we learned from the Holocaust. Jews who gave up their faith. How can we judge? How can we call into question? To me, not to end on a sour note, I think that there's a very inspiring message in studying this history in particular. To me, the takeaway or the takeaways are about mesirut nefesh. Mesirut nefesh, what is a person willing to do for what they believe in? Not, are you ready to give up your life? Because hopefully we won't ever have to be in such a situation. But it's much more about what are you willing to do to live your life for what you believe in. Instead of Kiddush Hashem in its classic sense, as we mentioned it this week and last week, in the classic sense, it's a person willing to say, the religion is going to take precedence over my life, and that's my belief. We also have a concept of Kiddush HaChaim, sanctifying life in the everyday, and seeing what these Jews had to go through just to be able to live their lives as Jews should inspire our own practice, our own Jewish existence, our own Jewish experience, in whatever way we engage in that experience, to see it as the ongoing opportunity to live a life where we don't have to be faced with such excruciating decisions, but to be inspired to live a life where we see the opportunity to live for what we believe in. to live for what we believe in, and to live in a way that is a mesirut nefesh, but in the positive sense.